Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And my guest is Dr. Charlie Glickman. He's a sex and relationship coach, a sexuality educator, and here's one of the more interesting aspects from my point of view anyway. He's a sexological body worker. And I don't think I've, in 5.5 years on Progressive Radio Network, I don't think I've ever before interviewed a sexological body worker, so that's going to be very interesting. Welcome to the program, Charlie, Dr. Charlie.
Well, thank you, Diana. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes. So, good. Good. Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And you have recently, relatively recently, moved from the San Francisco Bay Area to Seattle. So, you're in my neighborhood, and I'm so glad you're going to do the show today, and again, part two will be December the 15th. You have lots of interesting things to say, and I'm grateful that you're in the neighborhood, too.
Well, thank you. It's been lovely living in Seattle so far. It's great.
Yes, good. So you ask a very important question to your clients, and you're going to ask it today on the program, and it is, how do you reconnect with your pleasure? Because so many people, and of course I see this in my practice too, are disconnected. And your sexological body work can really help because, well, I want you to tell our listeners about that sexological body work.
So, sure, I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
So sexological body work is somatic education in erotic embodiment. Now, that's a lot of words, so let me tell you what I mean by that. Erotic embodiment is your ability to feel pleasure, to be in a high state of arousal without tuning out, without checking out, without getting distracted, without getting so lost in the movies you're playing in your head that you're not there with your partner. So it's all about how you can stay present in the moment while you're experiencing high states of arousal. And the reason why it's somatic education is, I was a talk-focused sex educator for many, many years. I still do, talk-focused work. But one of the things that I learned over time is that talking about sex in some ways is like talking about food. We can talk about it all day long, but if you actually want to learn how to do it, you have to get into the kitchen and give it a try. So
my job,
and so my job is to give people experiences by which they can learn new skills to be present in their bodies, how to talk with their partner about what they want, how to tap into their desires and describe what it is. Everything across the board. It's easy to fall into the trap of thinking, oh, well, sex is natural. It should just happen. But sex isn't any more natural than food. If you think about all the steps that go into making a meal, there's, picking out a recipe, there's buying the food, there's preparing everything, there's cooking everything. There's actually a lot of pieces along the way that if they don't work, your dinner isn't going to taste as good as you would like. And the same thing happens with sex. How to describe what you want your partner to do, how to even know what it is that works for your body, how to stay present. These are all things that we can learn. And as a sexological body worker, I get to help people build those skills.
And that's excellent. And of course, under my license as a marriage and family therapist and board certified sex therapist, I'm not allowed, and I wouldn't do it. The only touch that I have in my practice is sometimes, and I always ask first, hugging my client goodbye at the end of the session. And but I think there's lots of value in touch and communicating better. I mean, too many people think that sex should be natural and spontaneous. And so, somehow all this communication should be unnecessary. And, I think that intimacy, pleasure requires certainly more than genitals. It requires two minds connected to each other in a meaningful way. And so communication, verbal communication is necessary for that to happen.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny. We have, there's two myths that I think get folded into what you're describing. The idea that sex is better when it's spontaneous. And a lot of people will give as an example, oh, you know, when my boyfriend and I were first dating, when my girlfriend and I just got together, you know, we never had to plan for sex. It just happened. Mm-hmm. But I would suggest to you that there's actually a lot more planning than people recognize. For example, did you pick out your outfit because you think that your date will think it's sexy? Did you set out candles so that when you come home from the restaurant, everything is all set up and you can, you know, dive right into bed? There's a lot more planning that people do than they generally recognize. So, you know, when longer-term couples come to me and they say, oh, well, why can't it be spontaneous like it was back then? I always ask them, well, tell me how you used to get ready for your dates.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's everything that goes into that. There might be a couple of hours of preparation for some people. That's planning to have sex, or at least planning for the possibility of sex.
So what I want them
to do is take that same level of planning and just find ways to apply it now that they've been together for a few years.
Yes, it's so important. You mentioned picking out an outfit. I've been known to say, you know, you dress for success, you should occasionally dress for sex. And maybe for a woman or even for a man, you bring out your best exhibitionistic self and you do a little dance for your lover.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And so that's another way that you can plan for sex. I think the reason why people get hung up on the idea of planning for sex is because they're stuck on this model that makes it seem like it's something that you have to work for. You know, I think if planning for sex isn't feeling like fun to you, that's something where, you know, as a sex and relationship coach, I can step in and help people find ways to make the planning fun. Or maybe a better way of saying it is plan for the things that they already think will be fun.
Oh, yes. And so many people need to be reminded that at its most basic level, sex is play. It's play. And I like to think that sex toys are some of the best adult toys.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I worked for 16 years at Good Vibrations in the San Francisco Bay Area, you know, the premier woman-friendly sex toy company. And it's amazing how many people have this idea that if they use sex toys, it means that somehow their sex is not as good as people who don't use sex toys. I'm mm-hmm. going to keep coming back to food because sex and food go together really well. You can cook food in the kitchen without having, you know, a blender and a mix master and all of the other tools. But when you've got the right gadgets, you've got a lot more options. And sex toys really are no different. They just let you, you know, do more in the same amount of time.
I didn't know this about you and Good Vibrations, but I have known Joni Blank, the founder of Good Vibrations, for many years. I see her at sex conferences, sex therapy educator conferences. And I was in Palo Alto, I think I shared that with you, for 20 years, and Dr. Walter Bortz and I did two aging and sexuality workshops for this Palo Alto Senior Center, which was a very well-educated group. This was in the early 90s. And so then from that, I ran a group for widows, older widows, and kind of over 50, and divorcees. So after, this was close to Christmas like it is now, after one of these group sessions, the women left all giggling because we had decided that as a field trip, they would go to Good Vibrations and buy some sex toys, not only for themselves, but maybe for gifts.
That's awesome.
Yeah, they were all giggling. And this was about, 1993 or so. I remember, of course, going to Good Vibrations a number of times. I always like to try stuff before I recommend it to clients. But it was very original for its time. And then, of course, there were many spinoffs.
Absolutely. It was a real education, getting to talk to thousands of people over the years about their desires and their interests and their fantasies. And, you know, one of the things that I learned from that is that you really can't guess from appearance, from how somebody is dressed or how old they are or anything else. You really have no way of guessing anything about their sex life.
Well, that's
and
true.
And that was one of the big things for me, is because when I started there, I had this idea that, I can tell, who's going to be into kinky sex and who isn't. And, the number of times my assumptions have been blown out of the water, I lost count. And so It was probably one of the best educations I could have had.
And that was sort of at the beginning of your career as a sexological worker educator?
Well, I had been volunteering at a couple of different agencies and nonprofits for a few years before that, but Good Vibrations was the first paying job I had in this field. And then while I was working there, I went back to school and got my PhD in adult sex education. I also wrote The Ultimate Guide to Prostate Pleasure, and when that book came out almost 3 years ago, that was when I left my job there and decided to become a freelance sex and relationship coach.
That's great. And so, dear listeners, Dr. Charlie Glickman will return for part two December the 15th. And at that time, we're likely to talk more about his book, Prostate Pleasure. We'll also talk more about open relationships and BDSM. We might get to some of that, but I think we're going to talk more about communication and the difficulties people have with sexual communication and overcoming sexual shame for this program. Dr. Charlie's website is makesexeasy.com. And there's lots of really good information on his website, including his blog. And this really fits into the sexual communication part. You write about people getting angry to avoid feelings. Can we talk about that for a moment?
Sure. One of the things that I see a lot in my coaching practice is all of the different ways that people defend themselves from having to feel their feelings. Some people will withdraw and pull away, and some people will lash out at their partner or at themselves as a way of not having to say what's really going on. For example, I'll make up a hypothetical example.
Yeah.
If my partner is always late coming home from work, and I never know, I can't plan on when we're going to have dinner, I never know what's going on, there might be some anger in there, but I might also be having feelings of rejection. There might be, the story in my head might be, you don't care about me. And so I feel rejected, but it's often easier for us to get angry and yell at our partners than it is to say, I really feel rejected when you do that because it makes me think that I'm not important to you. And I see this with a lot of folks where couples will start getting into, they'll start sniping at each other, or they'll start putting each other down. And really what's going on underneath could be sadness. It could be loneliness. It could be disappointment. And it's really, you know, it's not that I want people to not feel their anger, because anger is also an important emotion, but that sometimes we use it as a way of avoiding our other feelings. And, you know, my role in that situation is to help people figure out what's really going on and how they can talk about it.
And how they can talk about it. And how yeah. they can get away from their polarized feelings.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And
one of the big ones for me with all of this is that, you know, when couples start getting into patterns of resentment, sex and intimacy just don't happen.
That's very true. I can't tell you the number of times when a couple comes in and they're still so angry at each other that I really have to do psychotherapy before I could do sex therapy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's you know, a lot of the time people think that they're having sexual difficulties, but really what's going on is they're fighting about money or what school to send the kids to or any of a number of other issues. And I know you deal with this in your practice, that we have to unpack all of that before we can even start looking at what's happening with sex.
Yes. I used the word polarized before, but I think it's important, Charlie, we should talk about this. Polarization happens when the differences that might initially draw a couple together become simply a wedge that divides them. And I think that we're often drawn to qualities, especially younger people, that we lack in ourselves. And so when conflicts develop and partners dig in their heels, just mild distinctions even might crystallize their differences that just feel insurmountable. And but these differences, you know, this sometimes comes out too through the Myers-Briggs inventory, but I think a social butterfly marries a mellow homebody.
Yeah.
But in a healthy couple, these differences might balance out, so the butterfly learns to enjoy quiet nights and the homebody goes to more parties.
yeah, it's always a tricky balance because, mm-hmm. you know, on the one hand, you know, there is that whole thing about opposites attract, and there's a lot of draw in mm-hmm. someone who does things differently. There's a lot of erotic charge there, but it can also be a real problem. You know, I had a couple that I was working with, a male-female couple, and she was very much, she was really an extrovert. And she loved going out, not so much a social butterfly as much as mm-hmm. she just really enjoyed being mm-hmm. around lots of people. And he really liked to have things planned out. He was less spontaneous. He liked having dinner with one or two friends rather than a whole group of people.
Yes.
And they had originally said what you just said, which was, oh, you know, I'll learn from him how to enjoy quieter evenings. I'll learn from her how to enjoy parties. But for them, that was such a fundamental difference that they just ended up fighting about it all the time.
Right. Extrovert, introvert. And we are drawn, especially when we're younger, we're often drawn to somebody who has qualities that we have not yet developed.
Yes.
So that's part of the pull. But you do have then a dynamic that ensues, and I think you've seen it, I've seen it, and that is the demand withdraw. It's part of that polarization. Communication styles mainly, and researchers have discovered that women are more likely to assume the demanding role and men the withdrawing role, and that seems to be across cultures, races, and age groups. And one of the problems is that, our local famous people here, John Gottman and his wife, mm-hmm. Have done 40 years of research, and they even point out that the man literally gets hotter under the collar, and that is men have more of an autonomic arousal in the heat of conflict. So their hearts beat faster, their blood pressure rises, and that old fight or flight response kicks in to high gear and they seek escape. So they need to go in their man cave. They don't want to lash out. And, of course, women are socialized to be more comfortable hashing out the issues verbally. So
And that's a real common, you're right, that's a really common pattern. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty there is that being able to even tune into their feelings, much less talk about it in a constructive way, that gets shamed out of boys early on. You know, we get told, don't be so sensitive. We get told, you know, just tough it out, be a man. And all of those things get in the way of a good relationship, because a relationship really is about being able to share your feelings.
Without fear.
Right.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the work that I do is helping men build those skills and helping their partners make room for that, because what a lot of women don't understand is that something that comes very easily for them is the result of 20, 30, 40 years of practice.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a male-female couple, she may think it's really easy to talk about your feelings, but that's because she's been doing it ever since she was a little kid. And so it's
hard
for her to understand why it's so difficult for him.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And when I hear that sort of thing in sessions, I'll remind my clients that it's easier to change the system, so-called system, by changing yourself than to change your partner.
And yes.
So then, of course, that's supposed to stop with a blame. That's intended to help stop the blaming, which gets couples nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, look more at yourself. So you also have kind of a specialty in masculinity and sexuality, and you just touched on one aspect of it, and I thought it would be very interesting to hear you elaborate on that. You said that men are often shamed out of being more sensitive early on.
Yeah. Well, yes, exactly. You know, it's mm-hmm. what the approach that I use, I've adapted from Paul Kivel's book, Men's Work, which is an amazing read about masculinity and gender. And he talks about the act like a man box, which is the, if you take all the things that the world said men are supposed to be, you know, big and tall and strong and financially successful and sexually adventurous, and you know, that whole list of things. It creates this very rigid box that men are supposed to be all the time. And when we're talking about sex, this is what I call the get it up, get it in, get it off approach to sex.
Mm-hmm.
That even in sex research, and I'm sure you've seen this, a lot of sex research, you know, they'll talk about sexual satisfaction and they'll just assume that if a man has ejaculated, that means that he's experiencing sexual satisfaction.
Oh, yes, and that simply is not true. I mean, it's often true, but it's not the whole story.
I've talked to a lot of guys who really feel like something is missing, even though they're having a lot of sex. It's because they're basically trying to have the same kind of sex that they're seeing in porn movies.
And porn is, of course, such a bad sex educator.
Oh, it's terrible for sex education.
I mean, it's just, people just need to remember that porn is entertainment. It is not education.
Well, you know, I always like to say that, you know, learning to have sex from porn would be like learning to drive from watching a car chase movie. Someone is going to get hurt.
That's good.
Yeah. But
that's a very good analogy.
The other thing that people don't realize about porn is that if you ever watch a cooking show, right, and mm-hmm. the chef will say something like, have half a cup of chopped onion, And magically, there's this bowl of onion on the counter, and it's perfect, and it's beautiful, mm-hmm. and there's no mess. There's no cutting board to clean up.
No onion tears that might ensue from cutting the onion, it's just,
it's just magic because it looks good mm-hmm. on camera. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had clients who were getting into fights because they were trying to copy something that they saw in porn, and what they didn't realize is that in those movies, you know, they turn the camera off, they change angles, they change positions. You know, they're using lube. They just don't let you ever see it on camera.
There's sure, and a lot of the guys are taking Viagra so they can keep the erection.
Well, exactly. You know, if you've ever tried to have sex with, you know, 15 people standing around with lights and makeup and, you know, everything else that's going on, it's really distracting. So most of those guys are using Viagra or something similar.
Yeah.
You know, and so people get into these loops. So coming back to where we were, you know, men get caught in these loops of thinking that this is the ideal of what they're supposed to be. And when that isn't what happens for them, mm-hmm. for any of a number of reasons, they go into a shame loop.
Yes, and that's something else that you talk about, and I think it's valuable. So let's move a little bit into that area. I think, well, guilt goes along with shame often, and I think they're kind of funny things because maybe without some guilt and shame, people can become sloppy and unmotivated. But with too much guilt and shame, people are at war with themselves. They're
exactly.
just at war. And they don't have as good sex as they possibly could.
Exactly. So you need to find the balance. One of the things that changed my thinking around shame, I used to fall into the camp of saying that shame was bad. And then mm-hmm. I read an article about sociopaths. And I know you know as a therapist, you know, sociopaths yes. are people who don't have any shame.
That's right.
And so they'll do whatever they can get away with because they don't have that feeling of this is a bad thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the turning point for me because if we didn't have shame, we would all be sociopaths. So therefore, there has to be a good side to shame too. And the good side to shame is that it's what tells us when we've done something that we're not supposed to do.
You know, have a conscience.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. The problem is that, as a culture, we overuse shame. I mean, it's a very powerful medicine. You only need a tiny, tiny little bit.
Yeah.
And it's as if, as a culture, we've decided, you know, if one pill is good, then 50 pills will make you better.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of our approach to shame.
Yes. Talk a little bit more about that. I think that's a very interesting point, Charlie.
Sure. Well, let's see. So if I do something that hurts you,
mm-hmm.
like say you and I are in a relationship and mm-hmm. I cheat on you and mm-hmm. then I feel guilty or I feel shame, one of those kinds of feelings, right? That emotion is what can motivate me to change my behavior for the better. It might teach me, you know, the next time I'm on a business trip and I'm in the hotel bar having a drink, you know, maybe I won't go flirt with that other person over there because mm-hmm. I remember how bad I felt the last time.
Yeah.
But that's how it serves us. But shame only serves us when there's real room for apology and amends and reconciliation. And that's the part that I think as a culture we have forgotten, that if you don't have that closing of the loop, right, if there isn't room for me to apologize to you and make it up to you and take steps to change my behavior in the future, then we never get out of the shame cycle. And as a culture, that's where we're stuck.
That's very well articulated, and I agree with you. And
thank you.
I have lots of clients where the husband has cheated or he's gone outside of the marriage. And of course, the wife is, and now with smartphones, the wife just is looking at his phone and just tracking his every step. And there's, it's hard to be transparent and to rebuild trust because she's so suspicious and so blaming, and it's very difficult.
Yeah.
To make a fresh start.
And the question that I would ask in those situations is, you know, what would it take? What would you need in order to be able to rebuild that trust? And frequently, what I find is that there's actually a whole history of unhealed wounds, whether in that particular relationship or maybe she's carrying the past with her and, you know, previous partners where she never felt like she could rebuild that trust. There's a whole series of things there that I think are important. And, you know, sneaking somebody's cell phone up so that you can look at their history or looking at their browser history is not actually trusting. That's not building trust. So that's not going to get them where they want to go.
No, and when I suggest that a couple with this sort of thing transpiring in their relationship, when I suggest that maybe they suspend this business of looking on the phone and just don't do that behavior for a while and see if they can't, with baby steps and so on, rebuild trust with discussions and expression of feelings and all of that. But it's very, very hard for some people. And oftentimes, if I look at a couple of these women, you know, the history is there. It's not, parents were not trustworthy, or there was disappointment. They were let down a lot. To put it in terms of attachment theory, there was a lot of anxious attachment or avoidant attachment, not secure. So they don't trust very easily.
Exactly. And what I see in those situations is an opportunity because you know, there's an opportunity there to do some really deep healing of those attachment injuries, but only if the couple can navigate that together. And that's where someone like you or me can really be of service.
Yes, precisely, to understand. I do bibliotherapy, so that means I give, I have big files of articles that go back a couple of cases, 30 years almost. But most of them are more recent, like in the last 10 years. And so I have three articles that deal with attachment theory. So I, when the couple is, I feel like, might be ready to discuss this, I give them those articles to read before the next session. And then we talk about attachment theory. And it can be a very useful lens in which to look at the adult relationship.
Oh, it's incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
Especially now that we have, there's sort of been an added nuance in the last several years where it's finding the balance between attachment and individuation. You know, because some professionals focus so much on the attachment piece that couples kind of get lost in each other and become codependent. And some practitioners focus so much on the individuality that they're not looking at the connection. And I think one of the most powerful ways to approach this is looking at both of those pieces at the same time. You know, how can I be myself as an individual in relationship to you as another individual? And that's really where the magic happens.
Indeed. So Dr. Sue Johnson, and I took her course recently, as I have David Snarch's course. So we've got Sue Johnson talking about attachment theory and emotionally focused therapy. And then you have David Snarch talking about individuation, differentiation. And they are different things, but I agree with you. There's a balance between the two.
Yeah. And we need both. We need both in order to be healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's a new book coming out. It hasn't hit the shelves yet. I'm just working my way through the review copy. But you might want to check it out. It's called Making Love Real by Daniel Harrell and Celeste Hirschman, two of my teachers. Which
so
is
Making
how I got
Love
it.
Real. Say the
making
author again.
There's two of them, Danielle Harrell and Celeste Hirschman. And the book should be hitting Amazon in December, so coming up soon.
Okay. And, well, maybe let's talk about that when we do part two.
Great.
Because maybe it'll be out by then.
I hope so.
I like Dr. Sue Johnson's most recent book, which is Love Sense. And the book before that, which was a national bestseller, is Hold Me Tight.
Yes.
And then, of course, Dr. David Snarch's book that's very, very helpful in many ways is Passionate Marriage.
Yes. I think you and I should just, like, trade bookshelves for about a year, and we'll just work our way through each other's books.
That would be a challenge, but also getting the books to and from.
Yes.
I have a bunch of books still in storage here but anyway. So,
yes.
Dear listeners, I'm talking to Dr. Charlie Glickman. His website, and I'll write this up in the summary, makesexeasy.com. And when we do part two, we're going to talk about his book, The Ultimate Guide to Prostate Pleasure. We're not going to cover that today. We have covered masculinity and sexuality a little bit. That's one of his areas of expertise. And, and on the 15th, as I said earlier, we'll also talk about open relationships and BDSM. So I'd like to just go back a little bit to communication, because this is such a stumbling block for so many. And so I had a client say, well, aren't there ways of communicating about sex besides talking? And, I said, yeah, some people think buying a Porsche is one such form of nonverbal sexual communication. And, of course, there's also the power of touch.
Yes.
Soft, seductive, shy, reassuring, urgent. And there are so many places to touch. The hair, the face, the nipples, and navel, and toes, so that's certainly is a wonderful way to communicate. But touch and symbolic communication work fine as long as both partners understand the same code. But if they don't, we've got to talk.
Exactly. And, I think it's always interesting. I mean, I really understand why so many people resist talking about sex, because it can stir up lots of difficult feelings and there's lots of concern. But I actually have some tips for making it easier.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Yes, for sure.
Okay. So my first piece of advice is practice talking about sex when you're not actually having sex.
Yeah,
by that, what I mean is that, if you're in the middle of a sexual experience and then you start having a conversation about it,
mm-hmm.
that can be a real difficult situation, because you're in this high state of arousal and then boom, you're in a deep discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to shift from one state to the other.
Yeah.
It actually works a lot better to talk about sex when you're not having sex.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. Gail Rubin referred to it as the non-erotic discourse of sex, talking about sex in a non-sexual way.
Who Gail Rubin is. I remember the name, maybe I'm thinking of somebody else.
She wrote an amazing article way back when called Thinking Sex.
Okay.
Which is probably where you know her. She's an anthropologist, actually. I think University of Minnesota. I could be wrong about the school.
Okay. All right. So the tip number one then is talk talk about it when you're not having sex, which I think is a great tip. And maybe that's on a car trip where you have,
yes,
you know, your lover can't escape because you're driving.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because the second piece of advice I always give folks is, rather than sitting face to face, which can feel more threatening, side by side works better for people.
Yeah.
So sitting in the car is great, or walking the park together. I learned this from a colleague who's a professional mediator, and what he said was that when people are in conflict and they're face to face, that fuels more conflict. But when you sit side by side, your perspectives are more similar, and so it's actually easier to have those conversations.
So interesting,
So go for a walk while you talk about these things. It's often a lot easier.
So many years ago when I was practicing in Palo Alto, and at that time I would see exhibitionists from time to time. The only sex offenders I could comfortably work with. I'm a female version of a... In my years ago when I worked for a high-end show as a showgirl, so I'm a little bit of an exhibitionist. This was in my youth, of course. But I had a teenage client who had he was arrested for it, and he was court-appointed to me. And he was such an introvert and all of that. So we did the sessions by taking a walk, and that was much more comfortable for him.
Yeah, for exactly that same reason.
Yes, for the same reason.
Yeah, less confrontational.
Yes.
So, and then the third thing that I think is really important is being able to tell your partner what it is that you actually want. And that can be really tricky if you don't even know how to put it into words.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there's a big difference between saying to a partner, when you're giving me oral sex, I really like it when you're more gentle on my clit until I get more turned on, and then you can speed it up.
Right.
Right. That's very different from saying to someone, oh, you know, do that thing you did that time. You remember we went to that bed and breakfast and had that delicious dinner, and then we had sex afterwards. So one of the things that I think is really valuable is if you and your partner have a great experience, figure out what it is that made it such a good experience.
Mm-hmm.
Look
at the conditions.
Exactly.
What was in place, right?
Exactly. Because then you can say to your partner the next time you want to do that, oh, let's do that thing. You know, let's have sex in that position because that really worked for me. Or, you know, when we're having intercourse, doggy style, it really hits my G-spot. It feels really good. So let's remember that.
Let's remember that. Yeah. Well, I just mentioned the word conditions. I think when people are communicating about sex, that the conversation, typically falls into three main categories. And one is feelings, and they can include anxiety, anger, delight, right? Desires would be a second main category, and these can include what I want, maybe slower, harder, and what I don't want. I don't want fingernails. Thank you. No fingernails, please. And then the conditions, and these include things about me. People want to have good dental hygiene first, brush the teeth, be clean, right? And then about the other, maybe needing that person to really look at you, the intimacy of eye contact, and about the environment. Part of my PhD thesis years ago was on women over 50 and their sexuality, and some of these women had become widowed or divorced, and they said that sex got much better, not only because they had a new partner, but they had more privacy. The kids were gone.
Yes, it makes a big difference. In fact, quite a number of my clients have been, folks after divorce or death of a partner, or mm-hmm. the kids are out of the house and they're trying to reconnect to their sexuality. There's a lot of ways in which, we go through these transitions and then things have changed and we don't even know what we want.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that's a lot of my clients, whether in person or over Skype, are exactly in that place. And it's really amazing to help them navigate that and figure out what their new sexuality is going to look like.
Yes, that's right. And I should mention, dear listeners, that Dr. Charlie Glickman offers the first 30 minutes as a free consultation. That's really a very generous offer.
Well, thank you. Before somebody becomes a regular client of mine, I like to do a 30-minute phone or Skype call. Sometimes it's because it gives me an opportunity to make sure that I'm the right fit for them. I've certainly had people contact me, and it turned out that, I wasn't exactly what they were needing, and so I was able to point them in a different direction. I always do a 30-minute get-acquainted call as a way of sounding that out and figuring out if we're a good match.
So, if any of you listening, we only have just under 15 minutes left, but if any of you listening and if you have a question for Dr. Glickman, you may call 888-874-4888 and you can ask the question. I know that a lot of our listeners don't listen live. This program is live as we speak, but you will go to the archived version. But if you have a question, do you have a way for people to ask you questions on your website? I think you do.
I do. The contact form on my website goes right into my email inbox.
Right.
So,
That's right.
I'm always happy to answer questions or find referrals. If you're looking for a sexological body worker who's local to your area because you're not coming to Seattle, I really enjoy connecting my colleagues with people. So anything like that, please don't hesitate to get in touch.
Yes.
And I'm also very easy to find on Facebook and Twitter. It's just Charlie Glickman on both of those sites.
So, on both of those,
Yeah. Please find me there.
And that's wonderful. And that's... that's on your website too. All of those ways to connect with you, and
I'm probably on Facebook a little more than is good for me.
Yeah, my fiance Brian, and of course I'm not on very often, which is part of my age and being a tech dinosaur. But he calls Facebook because he's on it a time suck. It'll just
it really is. It really is. It's dangerous.
But that doesn't mean that I shouldn't get up to speed a little bit better on this. All right. So did you have anything more to say about overcoming sexual shame? I mean, we did talk about the balance, which I thought was very good, we need some. It's because it's such a powerful medicine. But did you have anything more to say about shame if we circle back to that?
Oh, yeah. I do, actually.
Yeah.
Which is that, a lot of people try to overcome their difficult feelings either by, tuning out. Maybe they're using drugs or alcohol as a way of not feeling their feelings. Or maybe they end up avoiding sex entirely because the emotional side is too big for them.
Right.
The thing about sexual shame, well, shame in general and sexual shame in particular, is that it's not something that you can think yourself through.
That is so true. I've worked a lot with women who've experienced sexual abuse, and they'll try self-help books, and they're in their heads, and They really need to have professional help with people who are used to it. You can't think your way out of it. It goes too deep.
Well, and you really can't think yourself out of any emotion. You know, if you're saying to yourself, why am I still sad about this thing that happened, you know, 6 months ago? I should be better by now. You know, feelings need to have their room so that you can digest them, so that you can process them. And with shame in particular, what I think people need is a space where they can explore what that is for them, you know, explore where their shame comes from, how they experience it within the context of a safe, caring container. So it doesn't have to be a romantic partner, although that's one place that we can do it, you know, a therapist or a coach or a trusted friend. But with shame, because shame says I am bad and nobody will want to be with me, the way that we heal from it is by having some kind of connection or relationship where the other person stays with you and stays in connection with you and doesn't judge you for it. And it is so profoundly healing to be able to have that opportunity. And it's
really
not easy for partners.
That's really where you can have the most sexual healing is at maybe after working with somebody like you or me for the talk part, but then with your lover, you can experience sexual healing.
Exactly. And in fact, one of my favorite kinds of sessions is with couples because, you know, one person might say something that triggers the other one and I can help them stay present without getting lost in their trigger so that they can stay in connection with each other.
Yeah.
And that's hugely powerful. I wish that it was not as tricky a skill to learn as it is, but given that it is, I'm glad that there's people like you and me to help people navigate it.
In your experience, Charlie, what do you see as some of the major roadblocks for people that have trouble just staying with the feelings that are coming up?
I think a couple of different things. One of them is dissociation or checking out, and that's where I do a lot of embodiment practices, breath work, or grounding exercises to stay present in your body.
Right.
I think another one is blaming the other person. So, for example, if I say to you, you're making me angry, right? I'm giving you all of the power in that situation. If I say to you instead, you didn't do the thing that I asked, and that's why I'm feeling angry, you know, I'm owning my feelings.
Right.
But I'm also holding you responsible for why they're there. And so helping people find the language to talk about their feelings. And the third big one that I see happen is people try to make the feelings go away by minimizing them or discounting them. So I might say something like, oh, well, this isn't really a big deal, but. You might say to me, why are you making such a big deal about it? And so we really need to honor that the feelings are there, that we'll be able to move through them, and that, you know, we're big enough to be able to do that.
I think you must be very good at what you do.
I hope so. Thank you.
Because that's perceptive, and it shows that you have life experience as well as clinical experience.
Oh, I have so much life experience with not being good with feelings. I mean, the
oh, so you had to learn the hard way, huh?
Oh, I really did. Mm-hmm. I would not be able to do this work if it had not been for a couple of really amazing therapists, as well as my partner, who got me over some of those learning curves.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, that...
Yeah, nobody is born knowing how to do these things. We all have to learn it somewhere.
We all have to learn. And it's a much more difficult journey if you have a real dysfunctional family of origin or something similar or some trauma. and or some trauma. Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah, and fortunately, we can learn better ways of moving through these things.
Absolutely, and that's where therapy, sexological body work, and coaching that you do, and you've been working in the field for over 25 years.
It's true.
And you're, you know, like me, you're a real sex positive person, and you know what a difference a robust, hot, ongoing sex life can be, what a difference it makes in one's life.
Absolutely.
And in one's health.
Yeah. Yeah, and for me, you know, it really comes down to what works for this particular person. You know, for some people, a robust sex life might be once a day, and for someone else, it might be once a week or once a month. And, you know, what I want is for people to get what works for them rather than trying to fit themselves into some kind of externally defined box, because that never works.
That said, I agree with you, of course. That said, I heard on the Today, the morning show, about 3 mornings ago, I guess it was Monday, or anyway, it was recently, that these sex researchers asked a whole bunch of people. I'm only hearing this from the reporters on air, and so I'd like to get my hands on the actual research, but they found that people who had sex once a week were so much happier. And apparently having sex more than once a week didn't make them much, much happier. So the magic number, at least in this study, was one time a week. And I remember, this was a few years ago, but reading that the Swedish Economic Journal reported that couples that upped their sexuality to one time a week, that they were as happy as if they'd gotten a $50,000 raise. So that's an interesting measure, isn't it?
that is an interesting measure. Well, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, money can't buy you happiness, but sex can certainly contribute to it. So, yeah,
absolutely.
I think that's really important when people are trying to figure out whether they should, you know, be working late or going home and spending time with their sweetie.
Yes, because at the end of life, you're not going to say, oh, I wished I'd spent more time at the office.
That's not going to happen.
No, it isn't. And so to avoid those kinds of regrets, you need to get very conscious about what's going on in your life right now and how you can make it better and spending more time together. I find that the emotional intimacy that I have with Brian, my fiance, just incredibly contributes to the physical intimacy, and it's such a positive feedback loop.
That's wonderful. You know, it reminded me of that saying that the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, but the second best time to plant a tree is right now.
And love it. That's a great way to close the show. I'm hearing the music, and so we need to close. And thank you so much, Dr. Charlie Glickman. This has been a most illuminating program, thanks to you. And we'll
do it
again December 15th.
I'm already looking forward to it. Talk
thank
to you,
you
then.
Charlie. Okay. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
Bye.